You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So a major difference between the UK and the US is that the Prime Minister can ask for election anytime. He just has to get into a car, drive over to see the newly crowned King Charles III, ask him for an election, and then they go.
I'm pleased to have on My History Can Beat Up Your Politics a frequent guest, Stephen Byrne, formerly of What M Politics. Stephen, how do you think you would identify yourself now?
Recovered podcaster.
Recovered podcaster.
Recover. I think you say recovering because as is evidently true, you're never fully off the hook.
I always enjoyed What M Politics. It's still up there, right?
The episodes are still up there. Yeah, if you put in, give a search for What M Politics, you can still find them on our host site, Headstuff.
Well, great. And from Stephen's perch in Ireland, he is able to look down upon the events in London with great hindsight, foresight, and sight, and talk to us about all things UK and UK politics. And once in a while, I like to do that, give the listeners in where the show is principally about American politics, but I follow UK politics a lot, give you a little insights on what's going on across the pond, as it were, to use the overused cliche. When last we talked, so we left the Conservatives with a majority and Boris Johnson in as the prime minister. And they still have that majority, but they don't seem to have that majority in a moral sense just right now. And I made the prediction that Boris is going to be here to stay. There's no way he's stepping down as prime minister. So it shows you what I know. What's your general sense now of this, where we left it with the Conservatives in power and Boris looking like just a British political phenom that couldn't be stopped, to where we are today?
I don't precisely remember what I said last time, but I think I was still just as optimistic as you that he would still be there, or rather sure that he would just remain the Teflon prime minister and whatever people threw at him just wouldn't stick. But unfortunately for him, eventually it did stick enough. So I'm not sure if your listeners are aware, effectively the scandal that took him down was a massive scandal surrounding parties. And when I say parties, I don't just mean a few people sitting around a coffee table having some tea. I mean, they were having essentially raves in number 10 Downing Street, the COVID lockdown, which was effectively one of the worst impact. The UK were impacted far worse than most other European countries in terms of people that got ill and people that died. The government was telling people to stay at home. People couldn't go to the funerals of their family members, to use a case that's often brought out. And while that was going on, it turned out a year or two later that in Downing Street, they were ignoring all that. They were bringing in wine by the suitcases and for some of these celebrations.
Mr. Speaker, I want to apologise. I know that millions of people across this country have made extraordinary sacrifices.
Inquiries happened, things were revealed, and it turns out Boris Johnson was deep in the middle of all of them.
With hindsight, I should have sent everyone back inside. I should have found some other way to thank them.
Eventually, that did take him down. It's gotten so bad for Boris that he was called up in an inquiry by one of the, it's a relatively new committee in the House of Commons. It's effectively to keep the conduct of MPs as clean as possible. They investigated him for lying to the House, which is considered one of the mortal sins. Boris Johnson doesn't consider that to be as important a principle to carry. So he was effectively caught lying about the nature of these parties while he was still prime minister. And he quits as an MP since after he resigned, but since then he has actually also been banned from the House of Commons. So even if he was to wish to try and mount a comeback, you'd have to try and circumvent that to even enter the grounds of the place, let alone try and do it. So yeah.
which has been in constant use because of the role of fresh air in stopping the virus. And when I went into that garden just after...
Well, I mean, I think you were in town in London when they had their next prime minister.
It is kind of amazing. I was in Argentina when the big events happened in there in 2010. And then I was in the UK on the weekend of the knives. Chancellor of the Exchequer first resigned on that Friday, I believe. And then I was there for that. I was in Parliament doing a tour the next day, and that night would be the night of the long knives when they'd have the vote on fracking or whatever that destroyed Liz Truss' premiership. We did get out of there while she was still prime minister. So I was a rare American that was in the UK during the 55 days or what have you of Liz Truss.
Country should be afraid whenever Bruce comes to visit now, I think.
I will wreck your government. I will say this. I was amazed that we were able to tour the parliament and the presentation of the parliament and everything like that is great. And then they just clean up and they're able to conduct their business at night or in the afternoons or whatever. The other thing to say, in context of what we were just talking about Boris Yeltsin, I'm still in my Fall of USSR podcast.
Not a dissimilar comparison.
You're right. Boris Johnson. Two things of context, none of which really extricate him, but two things of context. One is that American politics, so different from UK politics, and that's probably why I made my prediction. I see a person of such like personality, charisma, and weirdness as well, but we have that here, and the ability to get popular votes with that from certain people, particularly his ability to pull Labour votes, which so you have the two parties, the big parties are Conservative and Labour in the UK, and I just thought, oh, that's a tremendous asset. What I wasn't thinking about is that it's not an American system where you vote for president. It's a UK system where not only do you vote for your member of parliament and that those members elect the prime minister, so you don't have direct control over who's going to be prime minister, but also there's a lot of little committees and a lot of, you know, a prime minister does not get full control, particularly in that Conservative Party where you have the 1922 committee that can, like, stab him in the back at any time. So
yeah,
he ran afoul of that. The second thing, just to know quickly, is like, because I think at first people will be like, oh my God, they're having parties in Parliament. But that alone, if it was not a COVID time, Westminster is full of drink. There are like dozen bars in Westminster. I have a
very
whole book
place.
On my shelf here of Chris Moncrief about wine, women, and Westminster telling these crazy stories. And on a tangent, a story from this book, a Labour member of parliament in the 1980s who was he just liked to cause a lot of trouble. The Palace of Westminster, where the parliament meets, is on the edge of the Tyne River. And it really is on the edge. It's the
right
building there
on the riverbank.
Is right there. I mean, he stood right there, had a big thing of scotch in his hand. And as the boats would go by, he's like, that's right. You're bloody right. It's all free. And they give us as much as they want of it. And it just trying to cause a scandal because everybody thinks that. Like, oh, they're getting it. You know, they have to pay something for their drinks, but it's cheap. It's not unusual, the celebration itself. It's just that it happened during COVID. But things have changed in British politics. You know, most polls appear to be favoring Labour at this point.
By a massive amount. And to be fair, the polls have favored Labour for quite a while now. You can even say that Boris Johnson had his last election in 2019. He won what the Brits would call a stonking majority, where, as you mentioned, he took an awful lot of seats out of Labour in what would be called the Labour heartland. It used to be called what was called the Red Wall. And he managed to flip a load of those seats. But the UK election system is very fickle. They use the first past the post system, I think similar to yourselves. But the difference being is that there isn't just two political parties that we hear about. There are lots of small parties, and it's very possible for most MPs to get elected with only 30 to 40% of the vote. And then the rest of the vote gets scattered among, well, primarily to the other party, but then also scattered among the likes of, if you're in Scotland, it'll be the SNP. If you're down in the south of England, it could be the Lib Dems. And whatever radical right-wing party is currently iterating in that region. So with all that, Boris Johnson, while he might have a huge majority, Liz Truss took that majority, and now the third prime minister has also taken that majority. It's very thin. It's very wafer thin. And come the next election, which is mandated to happen by at least January 25, but everyone believes will happen sometime next year, probably around the fall, that could flip right back. And they're actually talking about a Labour majority and victory the size of what Tony Blair managed to get back in 97. And an awful lot of the comparisons are being made between Keir Starmer and Tony Blair, because Tony Blair came in after a couple of decades of Labour not winning elections and spending an awful lot of time talking about issues that would be considered quite left-wing for the mainstream British public. But mm-hmm. Tony Blair came in, brought them back to the centre, and managed to win a big majority that lasted for a long time. I think he was Prime Minister for three terms before...
Three terms before Gordon Brown came in. 97, 2001, and then 2005.
Yeah, and then Gordon Brown came in and lost in 2008 after the crash. But Keir Starmer has a similar personality, a similar profile in the sense that he'd be considered quite centrist, especially compared to who they had before, which is Jeremy Corbyn. And he's always been teased and made fun of in the media, and the British think for a country that have the oldest democracy effectively in the Western world, they don't take politics very seriously. Most politicians are risible characters, and most policies will, you know, be talked about on the news, but in every other forum will be made fun of, and he's considered very boring.
I think they want a serious politician, a serious prime minister who understands with a careful, competent, confident plan to lead Britain through this crisis.
That's the profile everyone says. I can't believe we're going to have this boring man as our next prime minister.
The government needs to answer, who made the original contact? What was the nature?
But I think a bit of boredom is what the UK really wants and needs at the moment after what has been effectively chaos.
Come forward and answer those questions. I think they should make a statement.
They haven't been able to get any stability. I mean, just we probably skipped over the Liz Truss thing a bit too quickly, mm-hmm. but just to give a bit mm-hmm. of context. So after Boris resigns, there was a election for party leader. And again, this is probably a particular quirk that comes from the parliamentary system. It's nothing like a primary in the US where they have to effectively get votes off the public, or at least the public that support that party. It starts off in the parliament, and the members of parliament whittle down a list of candidates down to two. And then those two are the ones that go and seek approval from the party membership. And the party membership is also incredibly small compared to the size of the electorate. And also, nobody knows what the profile of the Conservative Party members are. A lot of people suspect that they're quite old, they're quite educated, and they're quite wealthy compared to the rest
of the population. What are the requirements for becoming a member?
£20 annual subscription, as far as I know. That's it.
Yeah. So, but that is probably enough to cut off a lot of people who don't want to pay that. So it's
not even. I think it's more the idea that a lot of people would rather cut off their hand than carry a Conservative Party membership card.
Oh, I see. Yeah, so they're kind of like here with the primaries. It's a little different, but primaries you'll get. I lived in a town. I actually ran in a town that had 14,000 voters, and in a Democratic primary, you'd be lucky to get 700. Yeah, so it's similar here. They don't have to be. Well, we do register. We're not members, but although the DNC has started some program like that, send us money and renew your membership. But I'm sure the RNC does the same. But yeah, so that was a very small election that ended up picking
with Liz Truss. And when I said that there was two candidates whittled down, it took an awful lot of coalitions and faction fighting to come to those two. Mm-hmm. And Liz Truss was considered the poster child of the libertarian economic wing of the party, of the Tory party, of the Conservative Party. And her and Kwasi Kwarteng, who came in as her chancellor, they had written a book a couple of years before basically saying that Brexit was the opportunity to make the UK the Singapore of Europe. Effectively, what they meant was very low taxes, attracting a lot of corporations and a lot of stock trading and financial services to London. Mm-hmm. And within the 55 days that they had, they released one. It wasn't even a full budget. It was an idea for a budget. And after they released that, The UK bond markets completely tanked. The value of the pound crashed. And within a couple of days, Liz Truss and Quasi were both gone. And they went back to the Conservatives. They asked them, the MPs got together and said, let's not have a proper vote this time. Let's just give it to Rishi Sunak, who was Boris Johnson's chancellor before he decided to knife him to get rid of him during the push. And it has to be pointed out that Rishi came from nowhere when Boris elevated him to be chancellor. And chancellor is effectively the Minister of Finance in the UK. I'm not sure what the US equivalent would be, Secretary of
Treasury.
Treasury.
But not also, as powerful, to be honest, not as powerful.
Yeah, the chancellor has this. They have, because as you mentioned before, they also work in Parliament. So they have control of the entire budget process for the UK. So it's a very important, very powerful position. And Boris basically picked him because he didn't want anyone who could be a potential rival to take the position. Oh no, look what happened. But it has to be pointed out that he was a nobody and he didn't have much political experience. And he's been in place for over a year now. And it has to be said that he has not done a good job. He has made a lot of blunders. He's made a lot of poor decisions. He's gotten into an awful lot of fights with a lot of ministers that basically just don't respect him, don't fear him. And it seems the attitude around the Conservative Party seems to be that we're going to get absolutely destroyed in the next election. And what we're thinking about is what we're going to be after that. And that's effectively the battle for the soul of the party that's going on at the moment. And it's happening between the groups who effectively think that they're doing badly because they're not right wing enough versus the old fashioned conservatives who think that they need to go back to a more centrist kind of David Cameron style approach to policy and electorate. And the biggest issue has been immigration. I mean, it's the political issue of most of the Western world at this stage. It's even affecting Ireland now as well. We've had a couple of flashpoints politically over that with the last couple of weeks. But specifically in the UK, Boris Johnson came up with an absolutely ridiculous idea that he would send asylum seekers to Rwanda to be processed. Mm-hmm. This was written on the back of a napkin and then promptly filed away. But for some reason, Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak have allowed it to become an actual policy. They haven't thought about whether or not this would be approved by the UK Supreme Court. They haven't thought about how practically it would work. And they also haven't thought about how this would fit into international law. So while the policy has been chased and tried to be implemented for about 2 years now, and I think they've spent about £70 million on it, not a single asylum seeker has been sent to Rwanda because effectively the plan is illegal. And Rishi Sunak, for some reason, has decided to pin his colours to this mast to try and get it through, he's trying to keep the two sides of the Conservative Party together. And when you mentioned those wild committees and groups that have a lot of power, the most recent iteration is a cohort of five particular right-wing groups who call themselves the Five Families, who tried to mount a parliamentary coup to scupper Rishi Sunak's ability to pass the latest Rwanda law, but they didn't have enough power. He managed to scrape by just with enough MPs. The law passed, so he's in place. But effectively, that will decide how far he goes next year. So I guess that also a major difference between the UK and the US is that the Prime Minister can ask for election anytime. He just has to get into a car, drive over to see the newly crowned King Charles III, ask him for an election, and then they go. They don't have to wait for a specific term limit. The only thing that stops them is it has to be at least every 5 years, so he can't wait too long. But if Rishi can't keep this mad bus of Conservative MPs who all think that they're going to absolutely lose their job at the next election together, that could happen as early as the spring or probably in the summer.
Yeah, talk a bit about that. So we're not as used to that because we have the calendar. The calendar rules here, law rules here. So it's every 4 years, presidential election, no matter what. Every 2 years, congressional elections, no matter what. There was a time where there's some, if you go way back in history, the 19th century in America, there was a time when congressional elections did vary. And we would have, they would be all over the place. But that was all, that's all been now a matter of routine. Everybody's on the same day. There, when you get to that would seem weird for Americans. Like, I get to pick when I have an election. And the famous example is Margaret Thatcher, right after the Falkland War victory. Never really enormously personally popular. I think that's what people don't realize about Margaret Thatcher. Never a person of huge poll ratings, but right after a successful conflict standing up to Argentina, she calls the election and of course wins.
Yep. I mean,
opponents are also in disarray. So that can be used as a tool. What are the factors here, though? As we approach 2024, I've heard Labor people saying, we think we're going to win this election, but we don't know when it's going to be. Some people are having to spend monies anyway. Like, I'm going to run ads in the spring, whether we have an election or not. If we don't, I'm going to...
There's the big difference now. So the UK system is quite controlled in terms of mm-hmm. what spending political parties can do. So your political parties can't buy airtime on television to run ads unless it's they actually get specific slots during election times that they like 3 minutes of video before the 6 o'clock news mm-hmm. and each party will get the same. And that's it. You're not allowed to buy airtime. You're not allowed. There's restrictions on political campaigning in the locality. So while you can drop physical printed leaflets into mailboxes, there's restrictions on how often they do them. There's restrictions on where you can get the money to pay for them. And there's restrictions on what they can say. So you can't say vote for me. You can say, here's some information that you could find useful, but most of the frame is a photograph of who will be the candidate. So it's quite controlled and it's quite contained. So when it comes to Labour getting ready for the next election, the most important things you need to do in the parliamentary system is have your candidate selected. Mm-hmm. So who's going to run? And most political parties will have that done 2 years after the last election. So you'd be in place for about 3 years before you'd actually have to run. And then you'd have your local party system basically up and running, ready to go. So yeah, it could. But if the difference being this time is that Rishi Sunak can't call an election from a position of power. I am looking at my crystal ball here. Unless he finds that a mountain in Wales is actually made of solid gold and all the country's ills are solved, Rishi Sunak is effectively only going to be able to call an election from a position of weakness.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. To follow trends, track financial situations, follow gains and losses, check out the Yahoo Finance Podcast. Every day, we'll give you a quick overview of the latest market and financial news that you need to know. You'll be able to hear about the biggest headlines in the business world in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. It's perfect to listen to while you make another cup of coffee or work out a new budget. Check it out now. Listen to Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
So he will have to go either in January 2025 when he's mandated to do so, or whenever he loses the support of the House of Parliament and has to go over and ask the King for an early election.
Yeah, so it's really all up to him, although there are certain circumstances. For instance, he could obviously lose the support of his own party. Or if I am not mistaken, if he puts forward a very significant bill like a budget or something large, and it doesn't pass the speaker, or someone could rule you're not really a government.
Well, that's the thing, actually. So the UK, for all their talk of being the oldest democracy, have never actually written it down into a single nice handy book like the Americans and the Irish have, called constitutions. They do say they have a constitution, but it exists in 700 years of law, and it's always very ch and sometimes it's pretty vague as to how it's supposed to be interpreted. And I've heard it referred to as the good chap policy. So it only works if everyone is acting as a good chap. So the thing that makes you prime minister is the king asks you to form a government. That's it. The king, if Rishi Sunak was to be declared invalid by Parliament, so they could have a motion of no confidence and declare him that he doesn't have the support of the House, the king could call a special committee together and ask for advice and then decide that he has to choose another prime minister. But that would be a constitutional crisis of the order that the UK has never actually experienced. The good chap policy has held up thus far. I think the closest they came was when good old Boris was refusing to go. He had, in a concession of about 12 hours, he had all the senior ministers quit, but he was actually trying to replace them as they were quitting to try and, like, I think he Rishi Sunak quit to try and generate an election and to get Boris out. He just replaced him with another Chancellor of the Exchequer. A day later, that Chancellor quit because more revelations about Boris's misconduct came out, and then that was the final straw that Boris realized he had to go. But it's very flaky. It's you never know what the UK system is going to bring you. It is actually funny. David Cameron, when he went into coalition with the Lib Dems back in 2008. Or was it 2000? It was 2008. He, as part of that deal, they brought in what was called a fixed term parliament to basically bring in a law similar to the US that you would have elections every 5 years, and that's it, to try and take away that advantage that Margaret Thatcher was able to use back in the 80s. It lasted two governments, and then they got rid of
Yeah,
it.
it wasn't really working, and they used it. I mean, so you've had elections 2010, it was 2005, then it was 2010, then it was 2015, then 2017, because Theresa May tried that snap election. We had talked about it a very older episode, and then 2019, where
That
the
was another
Boris won the
snap
thing.
election.
Yeah, and that was it. And I think at first they, using that procedure, Jeremy Corbyn was able to deny it. Let's talk a bit about Jeremy Corbyn and Keir Starmer, because on the Labour side, and again, the two main parties in British politics are Conservative and Labour, but there are a number of smaller parties. On the Labour side, one of the things that Keir Starmer has been able to do politically is to get rid of, well, first of all, they've actually kicked Jeremy Corbyn out of the party at this point, but he.
So yeah, he effectively has purged the Corbyn insurgency, but it is worth noting that that Corbyn insurgency was always very shaky. So he never expected to be made leader of the party, and everyone always questioned whether or not he actually wanted to be prime minister. I mean, only Jeremy will know the answer to that question. But they never really clicked with the majority of MPs, the leadership under Corbyn. They tried their best to bring in the kind of staffers and political system that you have when you run a political party in such a large country, but it was always very shaky, and it didn't turn out to be that big a job when Keir Starmer was elected after Jeremy Corbyn lost that second subsequent election to Boris, when they lost a lot of Labour seats that everyone had assumed were solid. He basically had to resign. He had to step down. And they did put forward another young lady. I can't remember her name, but she was effectively going to be the Corbynite. She didn't win. Keir Starmer won quite comfortably. And after that, he began a proper process of purging them, rebuilding the party. It even went down to like the local selection process that I mentioned before. When you're getting ready for an election, the local area are the ones who choose a candidate. But I've seen this happen firsthand, this can be very controlled by the head office, to the point that you can get a note from London saying, like, you could be holding your Manchester election and they don't want the local effective Communist Party guy to go and run for the Labour Party. So they'll say, oh, you have to have an address on this particular street. And lo and behold, there'll be some barrister who has been chosen by the party to be the candidate in the safe seat, and he'll happen to have that address. So, oh, okay, well, the rules say we have to pick him. And it's, yeah, that's again coming down to the system in the UK being quite malleable, quite flexible, and yeah, quite open to people imposing the kind of rules that they want onto it like that. He really has purged it. And it's not just that, in the attitudes of most of the public as well. I think the Corbyn experiment had its run, but they never really hit home. They never managed to catch enough of the UK public to get any way close to getting into government. But a big part of that help has been the collapse of the SNP in Scotland.
So Stormer is in a good position for the election, partially because of what's going on with the Scottish National Party.
Yeah, so up until, like, in Gordon Brown's time, he was a Scottish prime minister. The Labour Party could rely on a solid 50 seats from Scotland. It was out of 60. That was huge. That was a big, solid block that could really get you over the line in the times that the Labour Party managed to get into government, which in the 20th century and 21st hasn't been that often.
Harold Wilson relied on that block. Callaghan relied on that block. Attlee most likely relied on that block.
Yeah, but the SNP managed to basically, it was a very confusing time. So the SNP campaigned in a referendum for Scottish independence. They lost. The unionist side, the pro-British side, won. But immediately after that, the Scottish public rewarded the SNP for losing the referendum by giving them nearly all the seats in Scotland for Parliament. And they had that for about 10 years up until, well, they still have them at the moment. They still haven't surrendered them. But the polls are suggesting that it is quite weak. It goes back to that point I was making about how you only need about 30 or 40% of the seat of the votes to win. It looks like that might swing just far enough back in Labour's favour to give them that block. And, like, it's confusing. So what has changed in the Scottish public opinion that would make them want to give up this very specific party? Like, I mean, of all the political parties in the world, one that has such a singular goal, Scottish independence. I mean, it is a massive coalition of all sorts of economic and socio-political interest groups all just wanting this one thing. Have Scotland decided that they don't want that? No, actually, the polls are the same. Scots are still about half and half on whether or not they want independence. What's changed is that the SNP itself has been hit by scandal. So Nicola Sturgeon was the first minister in Scotland for an awful long time, and she was very successful, very charismatic, one of the UK's best politicians, frankly. She quit all of a sudden at the start of this year. And it turned out that there was a police investigation ongoing into about £600,000 of money that was raised by the SNP that effectively disappeared and may have been transferred into the personal account of her husband. And I mean, I don't know if we're going to have many Scottish lawyers listening to that, so please don't quote me if that is still a legal case, but effectively that's what the scandal played out as. And since then, the leadership that has taken over since just hasn't been strong enough. They've been caught quite badly with a lot of political fighting over laws around trans rights. So I think Scotland tried to pass a law effectively becoming more progressive in that space than what the rest of the UK have. But that kind of tore the party a little bit down the middle in terms of people who supported it and those who didn't like it, which is a problem when you have such a big umbrella party. And they just haven't been able to hit it in the polls. So it looks like Keir Starmer should be able to rely on about 40 to 50 of those Scottish seats again, which will be a huge boost when it comes around to it.
Yeah, and because then, the SNP themselves, I mean, the members of Parliament, it seemed like, were fairly on the more liberal side of politics. But the SNP itself has some conservative people. And I know they had that recent presidential election party leader election to replace Sturgeon, but seemed like a lot of different political voices there. It wasn't just all.
Usually so. Yeah. There was one, the second candidate, actually, the one who just managed not to win. She was effectively a Christian conservative, and then she just barely got beaten by effectively Nicola Sturgeon's protege. I can't remember his name right now, Youssef.
Yeah, so they're not going into a good position there. And Labour's running strong. How are the Liberal Democrats, the smaller party, doing?
Sure. So the Liberal Democrats are a UK-wide party as well. They are like the same as Labour and the Conservatives. They've been around an awful long time. They're what's left of the party of Gladstone back in the 19th century. They were in government with the Conservative Party in 2008 under
Clegg.
Nick Clegg, yep, who is, everyone might be happy to know, one of Facebook's main executives now. So he brought them into government, but then they got very badly beaten and shrunk. I think the term that we used at the time was that the Conservative Party ate their vote and managed to come back with a majority in the next election. They have never really staged a comeback to any way close to that. But the thing to remember is that they're a very regional party as well. They do very well in certain parts of the UK. So especially up the very top of Scotland and around the islands of Scotland, they tend to do quite well. And then down in the southwest of the UK, of England, down around Devon and Cornwall, they do tend to do quite well there. So while there isn't any feeling of a massive insurgency on the part of somebody wanting a party that isn't Labour or isn't the UK or isn't the Tories, there is a good chance that they will gain a few more seats than they had previously just by doing well in those local constituencies where they have traditionally done well.
It's interesting. In the last Australian election, so they had these groups that came out called the Teal Party. They had the Teal Party, which was like, we'll mix green, their kind of Green Party values, but servicing an area that's conservative in a lot of other politics. And it sounds like the Liberal Democrats, well, they seem to be like the rural Liberals.
Effectively, I mean, they do well in certain parts of London, but the Liberal Party is for the people who think that, you know, constitutional reform is the most important thing for the UK. Kind of policy wonks like you and me, I would say. know, it like when it comes down to hard hitting issues, most people don't think of the Lib Dems as being the one to solve the problem for that. You normally flip to one of the two main parties.
And then you have Reform Party this year. There's a new.
Yeah, they're not new, to be honest. What they are is the third iteration of UKIP. This is Nigel Farage's baby. I don't know if he is actually a member. He always kind of quits between being the leader or being a media personality. Nigel Farage was a massive personality in UK politics who effectively got Brexit over the line. It was him who pushed for it for a long time. It was him that basically scared David Cameron into pushing it forward as a Conservative Party policy in terms of having a vote. And then it was him that was always nibbling at the heels of the likes of Boris Johnson and those other Conservative Party leaders to try and to push them to a right wing version of Brexit as well. So after the Brexit election, you couldn't have a party called the UK Independence Party that was a single focus issue party to get Brexit because they had Brexit. So after that, he created a new party called the Brexit Party to get Brexit done, as was the word for so long over those years when they were negotiating it. That was done. The deal was done. So you can't have a Brexit party anymore. But he ain't going nowhere. So they've created the Reform Party. So effectively, the way to think about the Reform Party is it's a political party that exists in the same space as one of the more kind of radical version of the Republican Party. So I guess the Freedom Caucus, is that what you guys have over there to kind of keep them honest in a sense?
In the Congress that exists, they don't have any presidential influence, but in the Congress, it absolutely fiscally conservative, probably socially conservative as well, but doesn't want to spend any money, essentially. Even stood up to Trump. So Trump is small L liberal on a lot of certain issues, the infrastructure, Social Security, maybe not Medicare as much. They would even stand up to him.
It wouldn't be a direct comparison then, but I guess the Reform Party exists basically to try and keep the Conservative Party right wing. That's what their main role is. They do think of themselves as a real political party. They stand candidates in local elections, so they may be in councils across the UK. I think this group that used to be UKIP, used to be a Brexit Party, have only ever had one MP, and that MP was a Conservative parliamentarian who switched. So they will exist in these local elections. They will steal votes from the Conservative Party if they're competing against them. But I mean, your odds on actually getting one of them elected to Parliament is small.
Let's talk a bit about Brexit. So Brexit happened. The UK is a separate country from the European Union. It is no longer a member. How is it going? and I hear things that maybe some people are having second thoughts, even some Brexit supporters.
The deal is done. So one of the last sticking points between the deal between the UK and the EU was over Northern Ireland. So I can talk to that very clearly. So effectively, the island of Ireland has two states on it, the Republic of Ireland, where I live, and then North of Ireland, which is still part of the UK. So it's a small part in the northwest, the northeast. And since the Good Friday Agreement, which was signed to end the Troubles, which was a conflict between Protestants and Catholics in Northern Ireland, as part of that agreement, there have to be open borders between the North and South. We effectively have to act as one economic unit so that people can live whatever life they choose to live, effectively, is the point. Brexit was a big problem because you can't have an open border between two entities that exist in different trade categories. So they couldn't really figure out what to do with it. It was one of the reasons why we had all those elections in 2015 and 2017. And a deal was finally done where effectively the North gets to sit in both. So it is both in the EU trading bloc and it is in the UK trading bloc. Effectively, it could be a fantastic economic opportunity for the North, but they're too caught up in their own unionist politics about not wanting to be at all different from the rest of the UK that we don't have time to go into here. But
I know that, for instance, if you look at it from a party standpoint, the DUP, the Unionist Party in Northern Ireland, DUP people should think of them almost like Republican conservatives in a southern state in the U.S., very anti-abortion, very conservative, maybe not on everything, but I've heard the members interviewed. They do not like the deal that was arranged over Northern Ireland.
They don't like to put them in context. They're members of the Protestant community in Northern Ireland, and quite specifically, they usually have backgrounds coming from what would be the Presbyterian, very conservative right wing, Christian values, but also most importantly, unionists. So they don't want anything to change between their relationship with the rest of the United Kingdom, because they'd be afraid that any step towards moving away from the UK is a step towards moving to join the South, which by their very modus operandi they can't abide. So even though economically this deal might in fact be a good one, they can't allow that to happen in their eyes, because it would be a step towards the South and they just can't have that. Effectively, that doesn't matter. They've been ignored. There isn't a local government in Northern Ireland because the two parties between Nationalist and Unionist haven't been able to agree on a couple of different things, most importantly this thing, but everyone's just ignored them. The deal has been signed with London and Dublin is on board, so they're just being ignored. And in terms of the Brexit's impact for the rest of the UK and the mainland, it's hard to do. Like, I mean, how can you explain what causes inflation to spike a couple of percentage points more than it might have done before or after? I mean, I don't have enough of an economic understanding to fight one way or the other. I don't have enough skin in the game to argue for or against Brexit.
Absolutely.
If you were a Brexit supporter, you can find reasons to say that it did well. If you're a rational Brexit supporter, you'll probably look at it and go, maybe it wasn't such a good idea and things are a little bit harder being outside this massive trading bloc and having these extra restrictions to our trade that we used to have. And if you are someone that didn't support Brexit, you're probably going to say, yeah, it was a bad idea and it's not going well. It hasn't been a catastrophe for the UK. There hasn't been a massive economic crash. People's like they've had the same economic hardships that a lot of the Western world has had since the invasion of Ukraine and of Ukraine and the different energy things associated with that. But I can foresee in about 10 to 20 years a movement starting to rejoin the EU. And if that does happen, I feel most sorry for the EU bureaucrats who will have to start the whole party over again to try and determine. I think it's something that's. It won't be discussed in politics before then, because it is still a live issue and a toxic issue. Like Keir Starmer basically says, the deal is done.
So a Labour win will not change, immediately change Brexit. Yeah,
I don't even think never mind immediately under Keir Starmer, it won't change it. You'd be talking maybe two prime ministers' time if they were to have it like that, or who knows what the Conservative Party will come back with. But yeah, no, it's tied up in things with immigration rather than economics. So the UK still has a large number of people coming to the country effectively trying to apply for asylum, And specifically now at the moment, they're actually moving rather through airports or through train or through the Channel Tunnel train line or on the ferries. They're actually getting into small dinghies and trying to go from the north coast of France to the UK. And quite a few people are getting into trouble, and there's a lot of loss of life there. And also, it's just a very messy and dangerous situation to have effectively thousands of migrants trying to traverse the channel at all times of the year when there could be storms. And this is keeping that issue alive, that people say, well, we've had Brexit, but we're still having immigration. So what's going on? And that's one of the things that the Tory party can't get together. I'd say Keir Starmer has played a very smart line. He's basically said, whatever they're doing, we'll do it better, without being too specific, because it is such a tricky issue and such a divisive right. issue. But he's even managing to attack Rishi Sunak from the right. He's basically recently said that Margaret Thatcher wasn't too bad, and I'll do just as well as her when I'm in power. So it's like he's got Rishi Sunak completely cornered on all sides trying to come in.
I call it political shearing. That's just my definition of it. But I think a very successful and a good sign that a party's probably going to win, very successful politician is able to shear. Bill Clinton, when he ran against George H.W. Bush, was able to say on some issues, you know, you raise taxes. You said you wouldn't. I'm not going to say I'm not going to raise taxes, but you shouldn't have promised it. On other issues, much more liberal, you know, parental leave and things like that. We're seeing that here. It's crazy surrounding the events of 10/7 and the Israel-Hamas issues. So you're seeing separation among the left in the United States over Israel and Hamas, and young voters and people that had supported Biden now don't. You know, well, what are you doing supporting Israel? Which others, more moderate Democrats, say are looking at and saying, the U.S. supports Israel. That's what we do. We're their ally. Of course, young people, generally young people, I don't want to generalize, loved being schooled by older, moderate, former Hillary Clinton voters and things like that. I see it in the U.K., though, and perhaps you could comment on it, that while the Tory party has its problems, Keir Starmer is facing some issues over, say, calling for a ceasefire, having the parliament call for a ceasefire or not. That vote went down.
The Labour Party has it's particularly tricky for Keir Starmer. So Keir Starmer is himself Jewish. Mm-hmm. But the reason that Jeremy Corbyn, that we mentioned earlier, got kicked out of the party was on accusations of anti-Semitism. So Jeremy Corbyn, for decades, was an anti-imperialist Marxist representative who thought everything that the West and NATO did was bad, including supporting Israel. So he would have always been very pro-Palestine. Like he would refer to Zionism, he would refer to genocide, he would use all those kind of words that anyone that would be on that side would use. He toned it down a little bit, but not too much, when he became the party leader. And it was on that basis, effectively, that Keir Starmer was able to push him out afterwards on accusations of anti-Semitism. They got a couple of different, they had a couple of different reports and found a couple of specific allegations that they were able to use. So he's been trying to walk a very fine line, because he's aware that there is that kind of an anti-imperialist, anti-NATO base in his party. And I mean, this all, like, it effectively hasn't gone away since Iraq, and the UK had an awful hard time politically after the Iraq war turned out to be such a disaster for them. Effectively, the campaign that went on afterwards just wasn't good. And Tony Blair took a lot of that flack, and the Labour Party was like, well, if we're going to be if our leadership is the one that's the warmongers, then we're going to have to try and change that by being more activist and being more like that. So I'd say when it comes to taking stances on things like what's happening at the moment in Israel versus in Israel and Palestine, I don't think Keir Starmer is going to want to say too much specifically. I think he's going to revert to what you were saying, that Rishi Sunak is just doing it wrong and he'll do it better, but without actually getting into specifics about what that'll be. He'll talk about wanting to support allies and wanting to make sure that terrorism doesn't win and things like that. But he's also going to be very sure not to say things like, to Benjamin Netanyahu is 100% right or anything like that. He's going to try and toe the line as best he can.
Yeah, it's a tough issue on all sides, and it's especially tough because it's that line between, well, you're supporting Israel, you're supporting the Jewish people, which almost, well, Unfortunately, there's a small group of people that can't get behind, but most should be behind. Or you're supporting Netanyahu, which is a political thing. And until the government there changes, which we could do a whole hour on Israeli politics, there's at least the poll numbers are showing that a similar thing to Keir Starmer's situation is that there's a government in exile in Israel just waiting for an election to vote Netanyahu out, and that would ease liberal politics in the UK and in the US would be a relief to Biden because it's Netanyahu, that figure that really angers people. Trump possibility we could have a Labour government and then Trump could be back in the presidency. Strange bedfellows there.
The wind of change that carried my own parents across the globe in the 20th century was a mere gust compared to the hurricane that is coming.
But you're also seeing a little bit on the UK side of some politicians, like kind of looking at Trump's style and say, hey, I could do some of that. And I know you could say that happened with Boris Johnson. I don't know if you agree. I think Boris kind of was an original guy doing that before there was a Trump in politics that anyone in the UK would know of. But you're seeing a few figures, and I'm thinking of Suella Braverman. What was she? Home Secretary, I
She was Home
believe.
Secretary, yeah.
And some of her just, I'll say the most outrageous thing, to even where Conservative Party members, a lot of the Conservative Party members didn't want her in there, and a few that supported her were like, I want her in there, but I want her to stop talking.
Yeah, that kind of goes back to that five family grouping that we were talking about. She effectively was their representative, the like one of the most right wing versions of conservatism that you can get. She was in there to try and wave their flag, and like you said, while she was in government as a home minister, which effectively means you're in charge of immigration, you're in charge of the police, you're in charge of a lot of very important things in UK government. She was saying crazy, silly things like, I think the one that actually done her in was she accused the police of being bad because they didn't break heads during an anti-Israel rally in London or something, which as far as I'm aware was peaceful. Like it was a peaceful protest or rally. And just on that basis, in order to take a right-wing line, a pro-Israel line, she said the police should have stormed them. And to have the minister in charge of the police criticizing the police on such a strange issue was just too much, and she had to go. Since then, she hasn't done too great. She's been out of the news quite a bit, which probably doesn't suit her purposes. Which a lot of these people, what they need is they need airtime and they need fuel for their personalities to get in there. I wouldn't be surprised if her goal, it rather than actually taking over any kind of leader position in the Conservative Party, is rather to try and get a job on at a news show. I think that's more likely than it is for her to see any kind of a coup. The UK political system is just too, there's too many intricacies, there's too many checks to allow someone quite as Trumpy as Suella Braverman to get in, is my call. I mean, we could be
I've
talking
heard
about
some rumors that.
Prime
Well, I've
Minister
heard.
Braverman next year, and I'll have to eat my hat, but
No, not Prime Minister, but I hear some talk that maybe they want a ghost ship or a pirate ship Conservative Party. So the Conservative Party will be so beaten that people like Breverman maybe want that so that they can, oh, now we got 130 seats. I can lead that.
well, that could be part of it. I mean, a lot of what the thinking is at the moment isn't about what they're doing in government for the next year, which is what they have. It's about thinking what to do after whenever they're in opposition. And like you say, I don't know if they necessarily want to tank the party so it's easier to take over, but they certainly are. They have their eyes on the prize in that sense. I think that's really narrow-minded. I think that's kind of missing the point. Like the electorate are about to reject you for advocating for these policies that they don't like. Why would you double down on saying we're going to be the super, like the even more extreme version of that party, whereas the boring party leader is the one who's going to get a stonking majority, as they say? It seems very strange. I would wonder. Yeah, I can't see that they actually see that as a path to power. I think that they just see that as a way to take up political oxygen, to make waves in the political space rather than actually as a way to get into government. I mean, maybe I'm giving them too much credit. Maybe they are actually just that's stupid to think that that would be the way to get in. Because if they do that, then Keir Starmer is guaranteed to get 15 years of government.
Right.
He'll be retiring at 65 with you know, gray hair and a happy pension before, because the UK won't bring in that kind
and
of thing.
15 years and no one will have ever gotten excited about him.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm perfectly okay with that. I mean, people are calling him the next Tony Blair. One of Tony Blair's big problems is that he had such a massive ego. He basically thought it was all about him, and part of that was taking the UK into a war that it shouldn't have gone into in Iraq. I mean, we can get into the nitty gritty of it, but sure. it was Tony Blair that pushed for that more so than the rest of his party, and the consequences of that were still being felt in the Labour Party up to the point that they had Jeremy Corbyn.
I mean, Tony Blair can't even go to a book signing.
Sure,
there'll be protesters, and that is so different. George W. Bush retired. He's at his ranch. He goes to baseball games. Most
not writing
people,
that many books.
No, he paints. He paints. No. There's actually a decent decision points. I will say it is the decision points, but he wrote it in a format that made it easy for himself a little, as a in terms of it's little snippets. Decision points isn't bad, but I would like an update actually, but. There is outrage about the Iraq war at a lot of quarters, and it's interesting. I had a guest on before, is one of the Bush cousins, and his theory is that it's been silent here. So it hasn't been outrage about the Iraq war, it's been repressed, and it shows in the Republican primary, and that's how Trump was easily able to defeat Jeb Bush, using the Iraq war, the failure. What perceived as a failure pretty broadly now, but it's not the same blood and venom that in the UK politics just destroyed the otherwise able Tony Blair. But you're right, Tony Blair had a little bit of a complex.
He still thinks that he should be the next prime minister, I'm sure.
And there's this movie called The Special Relationship, which how factual it is, I don't know, but it dealt with it. It was kind of along the Queen. It was kind of along that type of a thing, and it dealt with the relationship between Clinton and Tony Blair, and Clinton being kind of a little wary of the guy, like towards the end there, like he really wants to go to war. Like, watch it, Tony. You know, these are ground troops. This isn't easy, you know. And but yeah, it is interesting to see the two examples where in your country there's been investigations and it's been just proven that it was a mistake, and here it's I would actually go with this new theory that I have, that it's repressed. It's repressed anger, but it's not public anger. It's not, we just buried it. The Democrats decided not to do a big impeachment over it or a huge investigations over the Iraq war because there were soldiers there. And we pulled out eventually, and then we pulled out of Afghanistan.
It was caught up in the in 9/11 as well. Like, it was a different narrative over there, I guess. And also... you had Dick Cheney as everyone's perception as the evil puppet master behind pulling the strings as well.
Lightning Rod took some of the blame away from Bush. Quayle for the father, Bush, Dick Cheney, and Karl Rove for the son, but all admitted that they were lightning rods and they enjoyed their roles to some extent as taking away from the. So yeah, the media goes after them. It'll always be one of those things that strikes me. But what else? You know, the Iraq war, separate from the Afghanistan, where Afghanistan, you know, had much more broader support here. Iraq was more the Bush decision. But it just strikes me. That's why I like looking at politics, different side of the aisle. Anything that where you're like, my God, Bruce, you missed this.
I think we got it pretty well covered. I mean, the most important thing is going to see just how much of an election that Keir Starmer is actually going to get. Is he going to get that big mandate? And then most importantly, what kind of, I think one of the most interesting things is going to be, does he run in with a 90-day plan, that kind of thing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
They've been effectively expecting to be in government for 2 years now. So what changes are they going to bring in? Especially in the context of like a post-Brexit Britain, the Conservative Party haven't been able to put any thought to that. They've been too busy, one, dealing with, you know, the massive oxygen suck that is Boris Johnson taking the air out of everybody else, and then after that basically just trying to keep their government on whatever tiny stilts they've been able to try and keep it up. But I think it'll be really interesting to see what can happen. I mean, I wish them all the best. They're our neighbors right across the water. It used to be the case, actually, that if the UK had a recession of 2%, Ireland would have a recession of 3%. Luckily, after Brexit, we've managed to disassociate a lot of that, and we're a little bit more independent, a little more integrated mm-hmm. into Europe. But at the same time, I love the place. I go on vacation there every summer. I drive through Northern Ireland, which is a part of the UK often. So I really do wish them all the best. And then maybe once they get their own mad politics in London fixed, they can come over to Belfast and try and get that up and running. Because it'd be nice to see. It'd be nice to see the north of the country with a proper.
Because that was true the last time we talked, the Belfast situation. Yeah,
it's an absentee government. It's actually kind of disgraceful. Like they have members of Stormont, their parliament, who are getting paid as sitting representatives for not going to work. I mean, I wish I had that job.
Yeah, no, it is interesting because when I observe British politics, they're always talking about, look, it's going to be up to what America does. And then you, to some extent, in Ireland, it's like, let's see what UK is. You're dependent on it. I mean, you're too close. The Irish Sea isn't that big.
Yeah, but I think after Brexit, Ireland had a real... We did a lot of navel gazing. We mm-hmm. tried to see just like... how much can we be dependent on what they were doing? And we stood up. We got the EU to stand behind us and to make sure that the Brexit deal didn't hurt Northern Ireland. And I think after that, Ireland has gotten a good bit of separation from what's going on in the UK. And also, frankly, their politics has been so nuts. It's been pretty easy to go, let's not follow them anymore. Let's do our own thing.
Great. Well, Stephen Byrne, anything that you're looking to promote? I mean, we have the What M Politics podcast there.
The What M Politics archive still exists. If you want to follow me on Twitter, I don't really tweet that much, or X, or whatever it is you're supposed to say now. But I am actually working on another podcast series about AI, hoping to release that sometime in the new year. So if you follow me at TheSteveByrne on X or Twitter or whatever it's called, I will tweet about it there whenever it gets released.
Okay, great. Let me know about that and I can promote it on one of my special episodes here. And then we'll have you on probably before the next election, whenever they declare it.
Yeah, sometime. Hopefully it'll be a nice summer election. Those ones are always nice.
All right, Stephen Byrne, thanks very much.
My name is Greg Jackson. I'm a historian, professor, and the creator of History That Doesn't Suck, a podcast that provides a complete overview of U.S. history through storytelling, yet keeps the rigor you'd expect in a university class. Starting with 22-year-old George Washington in his first battle, join me for a chronological telling of the United States' story, its unlikely revolution, fractious civil war, tenacious inventors, brave reformers, and more. With more than 100 episodes, you can already binge listen your way through the progressive era. Find History That Doesn't Suck wherever you get your podcasts.